Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi there, this is Cecilia, content producer at the Webby Awards. Are you making great work on the internet? If so, I want to take this moment to remind you that the final entry deadline for the 27th Annual Webby Awards is coming up on Friday, December 16th. This year, we're expanding our categories across websites and mobile sites, video, advertising, media, and PR, apps, dApps, and software, social, podcasts, games, and new this year, metaverse, immersive, and virtual. Check out all of our categories and enter your best work by the final entry deadline at webbyawards.com.
From the Webby Awards, I'm David Michelle Davies. This is the Webby Podcast.
Think big, be kind, doodaloo.
Democracy dies in darkness.
Boom.
Journalism matters, not the enemy.
Butterfly in the sky, bitches.
Hey there, and welcome back to the Webby Podcast. I'm so excited to be back, and we have a very special guest to help us kick off our first episode of this 10th season, LeVar Burton. LeVar has been an important cultural contributor for more than 40 years, first as an actor, where he's had big roles on big shows, including Alex Haley's Roots, where he played the lead of Kunta Kinte on the show that defined miniseries and storytelling for a generation. Among many other roles, he went on to play Geordi LaForge on Star Trek The Next Generation, a role he's played regularly for more than 20 years. But through all those roles, it was a show he helped develop and host aimed at celebrating and promoting literacy that I remember most, Reading Rainbow, which aired for more than 15 years and helped a generation of children fall in love with storytelling. Through the years, LeVar's passion for children and literacy has never waned, and he's now a Webby winner for his podcast, LeVar Burton Reads, which is, quite simply, a podcast where LeVar reads and narrates his favorite short stories. With over 100 episodes, it is a joy to listen to. So we get into all that, but first we start off talking about LeVar's early years.
I've been a big fan of PBS for most of my life. The Roots experience for me was one where I was really introduced to the power of the medium of television in a very up close and personal way. I was able to, you know, throughout the eight nights of the original broadcast of Roots, I was able to see this nation become transformed, changed around our common understanding of what we mean when we talk about chattel slavery. And the opportunity, it seemed to me, to apply that sort of power that's harnessed by the storytelling power, harnessed by the delivery system, right? The ubiquitous nature of television in our lives, to harness that power in the service of creating a link between children who are learning to read and making them readers for the whole of their lives. It just made a lot of sense to me. My mother was an English teacher, so you know, I grew up in a family where reading was like breathing. You had to read in my mother's house.
Yeah.
There was just no ifs, ands, or buts about it. The opportunity to really see the power of the medium in action, it impacted me in a very personal way. And I then saw the medium of television as a vehicle for doing more than simply entertaining.
It's interesting to hear you talk about Roots in that way. There's something, one of the interesting things about it was that it was, you know, it took place over those, that string of nights all in a row, which was
yes.
Somewhat different for the time. It kind of reminds me a little bit.
It was absolutely revolutionary. It's the first time that television had been programmed in that way.
Yeah, it kind of reminds me a little bit of what you see sometimes today in some of these streaming services where they like release all the episodes at once, you know, and that how that really drives so much more kind of conversation and interest.
It does, and so in a sense, you know, that broadcasting strategy was definitely way ahead of its time before Roots. And I think there weren't very many miniseries before Roots. It was really one of the first, but they were broadcast in weekly installments, and so it was very different for America to return night after night to a serialized story, and the momentum grew almost exponentially every night. I think it is fair to say that Roots was an early precursor to the nature of the binge watching, the way we consume our television content these days.
I'll just add a slight little tidbit here, which is just to emphasize like how global Roots was for maybe our younger audience who aren't as familiar with it. I have some French family and used to spend some of my summers in France, and I actually watched Roots some years later in France, in French, translated with subtitles. And it was the same. I mean, I'm sure it was different, but it had the same impact in France, you know, like it was the same thing that everybody was talking about and that sort of like captivated everybody, just like it was in the United States. So it really had a global impact at the time.
Yeah. And that for me is the power of storytelling, right? With story, we can have that major of an impact on the world. Not with every story, but there are certainly stories that do serve that purpose. And it's really important in culture when we can find one of those.
Yeah. And you spent, much of the 80s and the 90s really on, I'm sure, many projects, but one of them was Reading Rainbow. And you said one of the interesting things, again, me looking back at it, is that, you know, you've sort of featured these books for children and read them, but also brought in additional, you know, visual and narrative elements, sometimes music, sometimes just some like flourishes and drawing and stuff like that. And also a narrator that was not, was not the author, to really kind of bring these books to life on television.
Right. And then the rest of the half hour was spent exploring whatever the theme of the book suggested. We actually went to a place in the world, a location. It was an extraordinary show for its time because it really did sort of display the magic of literature and what it offers to us in our lives in terms of a window on the world of not just places but ideas, and is a real spark to one's imagination.
You mentioned there earlier that, you know, your mother was an English teacher and that, you know, reading was sort of like not only a requirement but a second nature to you. Can you talk a little bit about your early reading life and maybe some of the books that inspired you and sort of got you, in addition to your mom, certainly, but really got you on the path to reading?
I remember the book that I was reading when I got what reading was about, that the transportative nature of the activity, right? That you can, in the pages of a book, travel anywhere in the universe with your imagination. I was reading Captain's Courageous, Rudyard Kipling, kind of a sea pirate story. But I remember when I finished that book, I was consumed with this weight of sadness. And what I know now, which I didn't know then, was that sadness, that depression was caused by, I'm going to miss this world. I'm going to miss these characters. But I had become so engrossed in the story and involved and attached that just finishing the tale, coming to the end, catapulted me into this sort of funk. And to this very day, when I'm reading a particularly good piece of fiction, I slow down the last couple of chapters because I know what's coming. I like finding a series of books by an author that I can read, like, the entire series. I like to binge books like that. I have series by authors that, you know, I've over time, you know, takes a couple of years for an author to write a book. So, you know, they come out sporadically, but I've read the entire volumes, and now I can go back and read them in quick succession, right? Like binging, you know, a television series. And I love that, because one of the things that I love most about reading is being immersed in those worlds, right? And living in my imagination.
Yeah, it reminds me sort of also, as you described that, of that feeling when you find that a friend hasn't read a book that you love, and you the jealousy of that they get to read it for the first time still.
Yeah, right. That's kind of a delicious schadenfreude, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
It's reverse schadenfreude.
Yeah.
You know, poor me, but good
happiness for,
you. For
them, though. You know, like a sort of admiration for that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, you're so lucky.
But it sounds like, I mean, you touched on the storytelling thing. Is the storytelling part of it, and the imagination part, is that what led you eventually into acting?
I think it's certainly a part of it, yeah. I discovered theater arts at a time in my life when I was really focused in another direction. I was interested in becoming a man of the cloth. I studied for the priesthood earlier in my life. But very, very early. I mean, I was 13 when I entered the Catholic seminary. So I was really focused in that direction. And it was at seminary where I discovered theater and theater arts and immediately fell in love. And so as I fell more and more in love with theater, I became less enamored with the vocation. And in fact, the two events sort of dovetailed. My interest in becoming a priest waning, and my desire to become an actor really getting up ahead of steam.
And how was that a internal conflict for you, or was that something it felt natural? You found a new passion, and it was, you know, jump into it.
It felt like a very seamless transition. I'd already had questions, right, about the wisdom of cutting myself off from a whole bunch of life experience because of the collar, because of the office, the station of the office. You know, becoming an actor, really, there were no limits to what I could experience.
What are some of the, you know, I think you're well known for the role in The Roots and for Star Trek. What are some of the your most favorite roles as an actor?
My most favorite roles, you know, I have loved playing Geordi LaForge for all of these years. Having recently had an experience where I got a chance to play him again after a quarter of a century, right? And I found the experience absolutely fulfilling and thrilling. Other roles, I played a deaf mute once in a TV movie, another true story, Donald Lang's story. They called it at that time a very inappropriate title in today's context, but the name of the TV movie was called Dummy. I started it with Paul Sorvino, the late Paul Sorvino, the late great Paul Sorvino. Another true story, One in a Million, the Ron LaFleur story, TV movie in the 80s about a kid growing up on the east side of Detroit, goes to prison for armed robbery, learns how to play baseball, and is eventually paroled into the custody of the Detroit Tigers and Billy Martin. In his first season in the majors, he went to the All-Star game. Great story. I think all of the characters that I have been able to play in my career have brought something of value to me in my life. And I think that's one of the gifts of what I do.
I think one thing I observe from, you know, reading Rainbow is that, you know, it's a amount of time where you are, in addition to doing all the work on it, you're also, I believe, like really, you know, meshing yourself in those books and helping choose those books and all that, and all that that entails. And certainly in the roles, in the acting roles, you're choosing what, you know, what stories you want to tell or express as a theater artist. How do you think about those choices? Like, tell me a little bit more about what was meaningful to you in the types of books you were sharing and the types of roles you were playing.
Well, choosing books for a show and choosing a character for, you know, for a project, they're not really the same process as I see it. But it is about, at the end of the day, it's about taste and integrity, isn't it? You know, I believe I have a pretty solid point of view about the world I live in and my place in it, what my function is. And I see my function is one of a storyteller, right? My job is to bring stories to the people, and I do that in a variety of ways, whether I'm acting or directing, writing, producing, public speaking, podcasting. I'm a storyteller. Hmm. It's what I am.
Yeah.
Right. It's not simply what I do. It's right. What I am. Right. And I try and have made it a priority throughout the course of my career. And Roots gave me the luxury of being able to do this. Roots gave me the luxury of some sort of choice. Right. It gave me the luxury of not having to take everything that came along just because it came along. And so that the idea of choosing stories that make sense to me for the audience for which I'm telling the story, and telling a story that makes sense to me on not just an emotional level, but on a moral level. I try and keep both of those things alive in my decision-making process, right? It has to be a story that has value to the audience, but it also has to be a story that I can find value in sharing.
Yeah. And I think you've also done a lot of work helping children with literacy in general.
Well, beyond, you know, reading Rainbow, I can't say that it was purposeful. I didn't start out my career as an actor thinking, you know, I'm going to become a staunch advocate for childhood literacy in my career. It sort of happened, you know, to me, right? It wasn't, I didn't in any conscious way guide or direct this. I've certainly bought into it, you know. I did the work necessary in order to honestly earn that title as literacy advocate, and I'm really proud of that. The idea that there's a sort of a recipe, there may be for some guys. I'm not the kind of guy that can do anything that he wants. I'm the guy that's taken what has come my way and made the best of it, and also found tremendous value in the not just the work, but the journey that the work has taken me on, right? My advocacy, you know, I guess essentially began in my mother's house. You know, I was raised in Sacramento, California, our hometown, right?
Yeah.
We have that in common. Sacramento, as you well know, is the state capital. My mother was very involved in political life in Sacramento when I was a kid. And when I started, and Roots was, storytelling is political. Everything's political. Reading Rainbow in its own way, it became political to me to travel to Washington, D.C. and to testify before House and Senate committees on the value of continuing to fund PBS, right? There are politics involved in everything. And I think as an artist, you learn that the art and the politics actually go together. That one is an extension of the other, and I believe that to be true. And I you know, I sort of make decisions and live my life accordingly.
Yeah, I mean, the art is the opportunity for expression of some sort of values, right?
Yes, exactly right. Exactly right. And as far as I've been able to determine, literacy is the key. It's the linchpin for any human being able to rise to their own highest level of expression. You can be successful beyond your wildest imaginings, but you won't have reached your most full potential unless you are literate in at least one language. At least that's my belief. That's my belief. And you know, looking around, I don't think I'm wrong.
I mean,
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
One thing, as you say, that you've seen, you've taken the things that have come to you, but I would mm-hmm. also suggest that, you know, you've been a storyteller for quite some time. Mm. And I mean that in a very positive way, you know, you have, but the tools of, you know, but like the tools of storytelling, I mean, while maybe some mm. of them are the same, they're still writing and pens and that kind of stuff, but it just sort of strikes me that, you know, you sort of started off promoting literacy and telling stories through Reading Rainbow from as one place, which was on television. And, you know, these mediums have really evolved, but, you know, you're still evolving too.
Yes, absolutely.
You have not stood by and stuck with one thing. You know, maybe you think of it as what's coming to you. I sort of look at it and see somebody who's really been at the forefront of looking at and thinking about new ways. And, you know, even like you have this podcast now, LeVar Burton Reads, which has been around for, I think, 5 years now and has, you know, I said 100 episodes. It's a lot of episodes. And
we just started recording yesterday, season 11.
Yeah.
Every season is 12 episodes.
And, you know, I guess, you know, some people could say, well, podcasting is like radio. It's kind of an old school thing. But, you know, for people who listen to podcasts, it's not radio because nobody ever listened to radio in all the places that we listened to podcasts.
Right.
And nobody ever, the intimacy and stuff is just very different. But here you are. You're still telling stories, but in this new medium, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I was really interested in podcasting when it first came out, you know. And I consciously watched the space and it was the exciting sort of burgeoning nature of podcasting that drew me to it. Also that, and it was an opportunity to be creative without asking anybody else's permission. You know, as an actor or director or producer, you have to get the buy-in of a studio or a network or financiers. But I saw podcasting as an opportunity to cut through all of that, and it would just be me and a story and the microphone, and that's the nut of it. That's the heart of it. And that was incredibly attractive to me. It also, I discovered podcasting at a time in my life when I really needed some sort of creative outlet that I could control. I had immersed myself in the effort to take what was a television show, Reading Rainbow, and translate it to tablet computers for kids. I felt that the mission that we had at Reading Rainbow, the television show, wasn't done yet, that we still had some value, especially in this new digital world. And so I thought, well, let's see if we can't take what was a television show and make it accessible to kids through this new medium of you know, tablet computing. And I never expected to dedicate myself full time to being an educational technologist. And so at the time I was really feeling a deep desire to engage in something that was more creative for me. And podcasting said, over here, kid, come over here.
Is it fair to say that most of the stories you're reading are somewhat sci-fi fantasy, or is that just the ones that I've sort of gravitated to?
I lean heavily into speculative fiction.
Okay.
It's my favorite genre to read when I'm reading for enjoyment.
Okay.
But it's not limited to that. I mean, I've read everybody from Haruki Murakami to Alice Walker.
Yeah.
But you're right. I do read a lot of speculative fiction, science fiction, fantasy. All of those genres get heavy play on the podcast because, you know, first and foremost, I do the podcast for me.
God bless, as it should be. I mean, that's what makes it interesting, right?
Reading aloud, taking a writer's words and creating a one-off performance piece, because that's really what it is. I mean, I'm performing the story, right? I'm investing all of my skills as an actor in the storytelling, and I love that. And so to be able to do that with stories that I love and want to share, and with authors that I love and want to share. One of the things I'm most proud of is introducing my audience for LeVar Burton Reads to voices they might not have ever encountered were it not for this podcast. And I love that opportunity to shine a light on unheralded and unheard voices.
Yeah, that's the blessing of a great curator, right? Is that once you trust them to share stuff that's good, then, you know, the leeway of what you can share doesn't necessarily have to be popular or well known. Once you trust the person who's sharing it with you, you know, you're kind of willing to almost try anything if they've read or shared great things before.
And the cool thing about that trust is it's been built up in my audience over time. You know, I was recommending books to them, you know, when they were 8 and 9. And I'm still sort of serving that function as a curator for literature in some regard. And I love that about my career and about my relationship with what I call rainbow heads.
How do you think about, so there's this other side of the technology part too, right? Which is that there's so many screens and there's so much video, and, you know, there's certainly a world in technology, which is definitely not promoting literacy and is maybe hindering literacy. It's not the world you're operating in, but it's out there. How do you think about that? And are you worried about that?
I feel like as a storyteller, I exist in a world where there are a lot of different choices for how people consume their content. And I get that. I'm in favor of it. As a society, we have to understand how to put, you know, proper guardrails on our relationship with these devices. We haven't done a very good job of that. We're sort of in the Wild West right now, in terms of just the sort of unfettered access we give these devices in our lives. I understand that there are the genie's out of the bottle. We're not going to put the cap back on that bottle. And my battle, as I see it, is to provide an alternative for kids and their parents. In for those who believe it to be important to develop a balanced diet of content consumption, those are the folks that I'm trying to reach. to give them an alternative to screen time, right? And to encourage the development of a habit of going to various sources to, you know, get your content fix on. And the idea that by picking up a book, you can engage in your imagination. You can go anywhere. And I can't stress this hard enough. When you are reading, you make the movie in your head, right? When you sit down in front of the tube and watch somebody else's movie, you get their version of the movie, which can be hugely entertaining, especially if the costumes and the lighting and the cinematography, on top of being a good and engaging story that has value. But you can't be sitting there with words on the page and what that inspires inside of you, what imagery you come up with. There's just no comparison. And so I think that as a species, we have, at this point in our evolution, a tendency to default to the least resistance we are offered in terms of our choices as human beings. We don't want to work hard necessarily. We have developed the desire to have everything delivered to us now, right? The holy grail in tech is to produce products that have ecumenical access across all devices, device agnostic, they call it, right? But I don't believe that to be the Holy Grail. I believe the Holy Grail is actually one where you are striking a balance between, you know, that which is being fed to you and that which you seek out in your storytelling.
It's so interesting to think about it as you do, as it's not about stopping or, you know, some of these things. It's about having more or better or more varied, if you will, access to the others. Let's not try and stop this. Let's just add more of these other things.
No. When the printing press was invented, we didn't stop telling stories orally. we still told stories orally. And then we enjoyed them, you know, in this new format. And as the format, the delivery systems continue to change and evolve, I think we can't get hooked on the delivery system. I think our attachment, our allegiance needs to be to the kinds of stories that we consume. I don't think we're all that discriminating right now in terms of the kinds of stories we consume. We're just like, shiny, oh, I'll go watch that. Oh, there's 10 episodes of that. Let me go over there. I think reading is absolutely about, what do I want to munch on right now? What is it I want to feed myself?
Yeah.
And there's a big difference.
A few, I would say, not random, but just kind of things I wanted to ask you before we go. One of them, you know, you're talking about art being political. I think it was over the summer. I think it was over the summer. You were on you had a sort of surprise appearance on The Daily Show. It was great.
Mm-hmm.
You wanting to talk about conservative efforts to ban books, and the way you sort of did it with the way you all set it up, which is really fun, was you started to talk about a book and then it like zapped away because like it had been banned, and then it was like the next book and it went away because it had been banned. Tell me a little bit about that. I'm sure you worked with Trevor Noah's team on sort of getting that together, but also just about, you know, the sort of your voice on protesting banned books, really.
I feel like it's very much in my lane, you know, to talk about these things. And again, I buy into the political nature of life. I get it. And I feel very strongly that I have earned the trust factor. I've earned the credibility capital that I possess. And I've earned it over time, and I've earned it, by demonstrating a certain consistency of effort. And I'm happy about that. So when I get a call from, you know, from Trevor Noah's team or from John Stewart's team. I love driving home the message in as many ways as we possibly can. First of all, it's thrilling whenever you have people calling you asking you to be you. You know, when the Big Bang Theory calls and, you know, wants me to come on as LeVar Burton, or, you know, doing a guest shot on Community as myself. I mean, there is value, I think, in having, you know, reached that station in my life and in my career where I am known for certain things. I'm known for something, right? It's not just flattering. It's deeply satisfying, in as much as, you know, I really care about the things that I promote. I think I said earlier in this conversation, I stand for what I believe in, and I'm willing to be vocal about it in a business where that isn't always appreciated by everyone. You know, I get on my Twitter feed all the time, you know, the equivalent of shut up and act, right?
Right. Right.
You know,
yeah.
I like people on Star Trek, but I cannot stomach your political views. Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah, you know, they're entitled to their opinion. Certainly. And the block button is very effective.
Is there a banned book that you love recommending to people to read?
Oh my gosh. How many, how many? Catcher in the Rye is on many banned lists, as is To Kill a Mockingbird. Mouse is on banned list. Can you imagine? This is, it's just insane. And so much of the conversation that we're having right now around banned books also involves a measure of censure that's going on in terms of how we educate our kids and what texts do we use, what do we give them access to, and what do we keep from them. And this whole conversation about critical race theory, and I will say to any and everyone who's willing to listen, the conversation that we are having about critical race theory is based on a lie, a bullshit. Because critical race theory is not taught at the elementary school level. It is a college level paradigm through which to look at systemic systems in the United States and how racism in America has impacted these systems. That's not for kids. It's for adults.
Yeah.
So part of this conversation is really about censorship and our unwillingness as a nation to be honest with ourselves about who we are and what our story is.
Yeah. It's a fight over what our is, really, right?
It is a fight over who our is.
Yeah.
It absolutely is. This is America. It has always been thus. It has always been so, right? There have always been a group of people who believe that this American experiment is for them exclusively. And over time, you know, we have shifted the identity of the other in the equation, right? I was reading the other day about Idaho and its Chinese population at the turn of the century, and how eventually all of the Chinese in Idaho were sort of driven out because of the unwillingness to allow the law to be changed that that Chinese women, the immigration laws, prevented women of Chinese descent from entering the country. So and it was illegal for a Chinese man to marry an Anglo woman. So there was no opportunity to build a real Chinese community in Idaho. And so they don't have one. However, in some parts of Idaho, they still celebrate the Chinese New Year.
Oh man.
And what that says to me is, there's a whole lot of people who are lighting firecrackers and don't understand why.
God.
And that's America.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, maybe this is a good place for my last question. Did you get to work with Alex Haley on Roots?
Very closely, yes.
Can you tell me a little bit about like what that was like and what did you learn from him? I'm sure if you got to work with him, it must have been probably an experience you'll keep with you your whole life.
Alex was like a big brother and a father and a mentor, all in one. I talk a lot about my storytelling mentors and Alex chief among them. And what I learned from Alex is the power of oral storytelling and the need and necessity of a storyteller to be authentic in order to be successful. Right. Alex was the kind of human being that when you were in his presence, he was laser locked on you. He wasn't looking over your shoulder at a party to see who more important was coming in the room. He was that guy, right? At a dinner anywhere, he would go into the kitchen and speak to the kitchen staff and say hi, because he was a man of the people. He wrote a story that was foundational to the understanding of who we are as Black Americans, and he walked that talk. He walked it. I can't say enough about how much I admired him.
LeVar Burton, it's been such a joy to have you on the Webby Podcast. You're a Webby winner. Congratulations. It's just a privilege to get to talk to you.
I appreciate the Webbies right back. Peace and blessings to you and your audience. I wish you well.
I want to say a huge thank you to LeVar Burton for stopping by the Webby Podcast. To listen to his Webby Award-winning podcast, LeVar Burton Reads, go to LeVar Burton Podcast, LeVarBurtonPodcast.com, and follow him on social media to keep up with news of his podcast and other projects. His Twitter is LeVar Burton, LeVarBurton, and Instagram is LeVar.Burton. You can reach me on social at DMDLikes. Our editor is Kate Mishkin. Our editorial lead is Jordana Jarrett. Our producer is Cecilia Betzel. Music is Poddington Bear. Claire Graves is our president. I'm your host, David Michelle Davies, and this is the Webby Podcast.